Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Exiled Tibetans from around the world gathered last week in the Indian mountain town of Dharamsala and debated how to fight the march of time. Their autonomy movement seems to be getting nowhere. Their leader, the Dalai Lama, is getting older. Mighty China doesn't want to hear about Tibetan autonomy. Not a bit. This hour, On Point, the fate of Tibet. You can join the conversation. Are you still rooting for the red-robed Buddhists and their struggle to reclaim their kingdom at the roof of the world? Will that struggle outlast the Dalai Lama? Will old Tibet simply disappear one day under a wave of Chinese immigration and development? We begin today in India's Dharamsala, the high mountain seat of the Tibetan government in exile. For the last week, more than 500 Tibetan exiles from across the world gathered in Dharamsala to debate their way forward, whether to stick with the Dalai Lama's peaceful middle way, search for autonomy within China, or to reach openly for independence. There's the sound of opening ceremonies from the big gathering, the biggest in decades gathering of exiles in Dharamsala last week. We're joined right now from Dharamsala by Tsewang Rigzin. He's president of the Tibetan Youth Congress, an exile group that advocates full independence from China. Tsewang Rigzin, thank you very much for joining us from Dharamsala.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm well. The headlines out of your week-long meeting say that you all have decided to stick with the Dalai Lama's approach, smiling, conciliatory, not pushing for independence. Are you satisfied with this?
Well, I mean, I'm not completely satisfied with it, simply because, you know, what you said, you know, the middle way policy will be is to be continued. So in terms of that, you know, I'm not completely satisfied. But at the same time, if we look at the bigger picture, that same recommendation also indicates that if China does not respond in a positively in a short time frame, then, you know, we will revert our goal to independence. So looking at that, you know, that's a positive thing for us.
China is very powerful. It has shown zero interest in autonomy and a fierce opposition to any talk of independence. What was the mood at the meeting in Dharamsala, Tsewang Rigzin? Is there hope for those Tibetans who wish for these things or despair?
Well, I think, you know, definitely there was some hope. You know, when we looked at all the reports from the different groups that we had, 15 of them, almost in all the groups, you know, there were mentioned about independence. People who had, you know, stood for independence all their life, and there are people who had, you know, followed the middle way policy, but because of the stalemate, because of the failure of the talks, you know, there are people who said that enough is enough. You know, I'm changing my stand to independence. So, you know, we still have some hope.
The middle way, as the Dalai Lama has described it, means not simply accepting full Chinese authority, pushing for autonomy, but not pushing either for independence. If the Tibetan exile movement should ever decide to push for independence, what would that mean? How would that push differ from the Dalai Lama's efforts over many years?
Well, I think, you know, when we talk about independence, you know, we're talking about our historical right. You know, Tibet was an independent nation a long time ago before the Chinese invasion in 1959. And if we look at, you know, if we look at the current situation inside Tibet, or actually 60 years of Chinese occupation, Tibetans have been brutally suppressed by the illegal communist Chinese regime in Tibet. And so looking at those two scenarios, and then all the evil policies that's being implemented by the Chinese government to wipe out the Tibetan nation and its people, you know, it's totally unacceptable for us. And we strongly believe more than ever that independence is the only solution for the very survival of the Tibetan nation and its people.
But you know how vigorously China has resisted any movement in that direction. There were, of course, protests this spring, and a strong Chinese crackdown after that. The Dalai Lama has essentially appeared to the world to approach China with a smile and a soft kind of approach, request for dialogue. If you should ever shift to an independence movement, would your means of working for that shift as well?
Well, I mean, I don't think so. You know, if we are talking about violence or nonviolence, you know, violence is not an option for us at this time. So I think we would, you know, follow the nonviolent approach, and, you know, we'll have to continue our struggle based on that principle. But, you know, we strongly believe, again, that, you know, independence is the only solution for the very survival of the Tibetan nation and our people.
Can you imagine achieving that in your lifetime, in the Dalai Lama's lifetime, or is this a goal years, decades away?
Well, I mean, we realize that, you know, this is a struggle of a nation and its people, and this cannot be achieved overnight or in a couple years. We know that, you know, it takes time. We will be patient. We'll continue with that patience. But as long as, you know, we continue with the hope, the courage, and the determination.
You have 1 minute remaining.
It sounds like our calling card from Dhamsala has run out. We thank Tsewang Rigjin, president of the Tibetan Youth Congress, for joining us from the mountains of far northern India there in Dharamsala, where for the last week, exiled Tibetans, nearly 600, have met to debate the way forward for a land and a people that has not had much of a receptive audience in Beijing for a long time. 1950, the People's Liberation Army went into Tibet. 1959, the Dalai Lama fled into India, and that condition remains today. I want to turn now to a couple of guests. First, joining me from New York is Robert Barnett. He teaches modern Tibetan studies at Columbia University in New York, considered to be one of the top scholars on Tibet in this country. Robbie Barnett, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And joining us from Vancouver, Canada, it's Tsering Shakya, Tibetan scholar and professor at the University of British Columbia's Institute for Asian Research. Born in Lhasa, he also fled to India with his family after the People's Liberation Army moved in. Tsering Shakya, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Rob.
Robbie, first to you, how do you sum up the state of Tibetan autonomy hopes at this moment? Beijing very recently, very vigorously saying no, forget about it. And here we have hundreds meeting in Dharamsala. Is this a moment somehow of hope in spite of what's going on, or not?
Yes, it does seem, looking at the press reports in the last week or so that have been very, very prominent about this meeting in Dharamsala, that the Tibetans are able to conjure hope out of nothingness in a way, because, as you said, Beijing has moved in the last few days really to a much, much stronger position, denying any discussion of this autonomy question. So some 2 weeks ago they announced that autonomy was perfect, the autonomy system within China could not be modified, and certainly not by Tibetan exiles. So this is a very strong door being shut in the face of the Tibetans in terms of any conversation about autonomy. And at the same time, it comes on the tails of a decision by the British government, a historic decision, to withdraw their historic recognition of Tibet's autonomy. So the Tibetans should be facing a tough time, but they seem to be making conjuring a sense of hope out of this.
Tsering Shakya in Vancouver, the final vote, however, was not to give up on the Dalai Lama's middle way, peaceful search for autonomy, but rather to continue to support it, not to go for an independence movement. Why do you think the majority of these exiled delegates in Dharamsala have once again lined up behind the Dalai Lama, in spite of the fact that his approach has not brought what they have sought?
I think that's a 2 points. Firstly, I think there's a sense that the autonomy claims offered by the Dalai Lama and the middle way approach is seen by the Tibetans and to some extent to international community as a very reasonable grounds for negotiation. And for the Tibetan side, one of the important sort of propaganda claims or the publicity for the international community to appear to be reasonable in their demand. So in that sense, the autonomy demand is sort of seen as being effective, not only in terms of dealing with China, but also in terms of getting international support for the Tibetan cause.
But, Robbie, while the Tibetans have perhaps looked reasonable, Tibet itself has come further under Chinese control, further deeper into the Chinese economy, many more Han Chinese, ethnic Chinese moving into Tibet. The facts on the ground are changing.
Yes, And particularly this year, because there were those very significant protests that you mentioned in the spring of this year, that very importantly, there were about 125 of them, and about 20 of them involved some violence, or mainly against government buildings. They spread across the whole Tibetan plateau. That's much larger than the area that China considers to be Tibet. But the migration question that you mentioned so far really only affects people in the towns, in the cities. What's very significant about those protests is that they came largely from the countryside and from people, farmers, nomads and so on, who were those that the Communist Party thought had benefited the most from the takeover in the 1950s. So China is pushing migration very hard, or encouraging it in the towns. It's yet to move people towards the countryside, but it still sees opposition in that area.
And when you say move people, you mean move ethnic Han Chinese from deep in the heart of China's billion-plus population into the high mountain regions of Tibet.
It's probably because those regions are high that this hasn't happened many generations ago. And there was discussion of mass movement by Mao and some of his leaders, even as late as 1980. They've never done that. The movement we're talking about is not a forced movement. It's not forced migration or anything like that. It's not what we see in Xinjiang in the far west of China or in Inner Mongolia. It's smaller numbers of people who are just encouraged by financial and rhetorical statements from the government to go and make more money there. But as I say, mainly in the towns so far.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the fate of Tibet. There sounds from last week in the Indian city of Dharamsala, where the Tibetan government in exile and exile groups gathered to chart a way forward. Tibet struggling with the power of China, the passage of time, and the aging of the now 73-year-old Dalai Lama. A big debate last week over how to move ahead, calls for an independence movement, but in the end a vote for the more conciliatory path of the Dalai Lama for now, that is looking for autonomy. But China is saying no pretty loudly and pretty clearly. We've been joined from New York by Robert Barnett. He teaches modern Tibetan studies at Columbia University. And from Vancouver, Canada, by Tsering Shakya, Tibetan scholar, professor at the University of British Columbia's Institute for Asian Research. The Dalai Lama has pushed for years. Of course, he got the Nobel Peace Prize. It has projected an image of smiling spiritual leader and is just that to many people around the world. But even he expressing frustration. Here he is talking with the BBC about 3 weeks ago, saying that he was getting nowhere in his efforts to negotiate a way forward with the Chinese government.
My faith, my trust towards the Chinese government now become thinner. unfortunately, they always, you see, say something, doing something different.
His faith, his trust, he says, becoming thinner in the Chinese government. He said something like that again yesterday in Dharamsala at the end of the week-long meeting there. He had stayed away from this conference to let others and younger Tibetans in exile kind of hash it out. But he held a press conference yesterday after the bigger conference was over. He repeated his recent comment that his trust in the Chinese government was wearing very thin, but said the way forward may be to deal with the Chinese people instead.
My faith towards Chinese people never shaken. Just I told the Tibetan, in the sense of dialogue, two levels, dialogue with government, dialogue with people.
Dialogue with people, that may be a tall order in this case. That's the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala, India, yesterday. I want to get a view of someone who's recently come out of Tibet. Not many reporters have been there since the trouble in Tibet in the spring. China has kept it quite closed. But Cameron Stewart, associate editor at the Australian newspaper, is one of a handful of Western journalists to have been in Tibet since the March riots. He was in China and in Tibet from November 2nd until November 5th. He joins us now from Melbourne, Australia. Cameron Stewart, thanks very much for being here.
Pleasure, Tom.
What was the atmosphere that you saw in Tibet? And I take it you were mainly in the capital of Lhasa.
That's right, yes. We spent 4 days in the capital. And the atmosphere is, well, it's fairly schizophrenic, to be honest, in the sense that on one level the city goes about its business on a fairly normal and regular basis. you know, Tibetans are very much out in force on the streets, in the markets, going about their daily business. And it appears, at face value, to be functioning like any sort of normal Asian city, except, of course, for the very strong presence of soldiers on the street. And we found that presence to be really quite overwhelming and very, very surprising. The extent of it is really quite remarkable. If you walk around the main Dzogchen temple area in the Tibetan quarter of the city, you really can't stand for more than 5 minutes without having a patrol of five or six Chinese troops pass you by. And when you look on the up on the roofs around that area, they have people with soldiers with guns stationed on the roof. So while it is quite a peaceful scene at one level, it's very disconcerting at another level, because that presence is quite significant.
Cameron, was there any evidence of the sometimes violent protests that Lhasa and many other Tibetan sites saw this spring? Is that all cleaned up now? The reports then were of, yes, some government buildings attacked, of reports, I don't know, but of Chinese-owned stores attacked. Any evidence of that remaining?
No, Tom, absolutely no evidence at all that we could see. And we saw everything appeared to be fairly normal. Of course, any incident such as that you would think would be fixed up or hidden in some form. But we couldn't see anything along those lines. What we did see was a very significant CCTV presence. There are cameras everywhere. The few people who we could manage to speak to who weren't part of the Chinese party, if you like, spoke of detectives, they called them, plainclothes detectives walking around. And so there's a lot more surveillance than meets the eye, but we could not see anything that resembled burnt-out buildings or anything along those lines.
Here's some of the sound from Lhasa last March, courtesy of CNN, of riots there. Saring Shakya in Vancouver, Canada, what do you know about the aftermath of these protests in the spring in Tibet? How many jailed? How many died in these? What's known about the numbers?
Well, it's very difficult to find out exact numbers of people who were arrested or people who... there's sort of very conflicting evidence. From the Chinese side, they only give figures for the number of people who died because of the Tibetans' protests, because there was a group of girls who were died in the shop because the protesters set fire to the shop. And for the Tibetan side, the various figures are given, not just in Lhasa, but in the whole of the Tibetan plateau. Some speak of 200, 300. We really don't know exactly how many people were killed. But we do know of some of the people who were killed and who have been arrested, just simply that the people used their cell phones to take pictures of the dead bodies, and which have been sent to India and to outside. Also, we have names of individuals who have disappeared or arrested by written by Tibetan bloggers inside Tibet and posting on the internet. So in terms of figures, it's really hard to ascertain accurately. One thing is quite clear, that the presence of the military is and the security force in all the Tibetan area is a very high, and there's a very strict surveillance of movement and of people. Almost all the cadres or the government official workers are under constant sort of a test for loyalties and meetings held in their work units to find out their loyalties. And each worker has to sort of voice his or her loyalty to the party and to China. And the monasteries are really now sealed, and they are sort of also being subject to education, you know, what's called patriotic education. Mm-hmm. That is to government trying to promote the monks to think and feel that they are part of China. And but there's a severe restriction of the movements of the monks from the in and out of the monastery. But I think this will the problem of sort of security and the presence of the military personnel will go on for some time because I think China hasn't really able to gain the control of the situation.
Cameron Stewart writes about at nightfall in Lhasa, hundreds of Chinese troops fanning out across the city with riot shields and assault rifles. Here's the Dalai Lama talking with the BBC on October 30th, saying his primary concern is conditions inside Tibet and saying those conditions aren't good.
Now the suppression is much, much increased. Very, very tight control. Something like military occupation, like that. Sometimes I feel the Tibetan people now almost as if passing through death sentence, something like that.
The Dalai Lama on October 30th. Cameron Stewart, were you able to speak freely with Tibetans in Lhasa or not, given the circumstances of your tour there?
Well, Tom, we could only speak freely to Tibetans on our own initiative, really, because the program that we got, not surprisingly, was organized by the Chinese government and included mainly politicians at various levels and Communist Party figures. And, for example, on the program they had one meeting with a religious figure, and even that was not a Buddhist. It was the Minister for Religion in the Tibetan Autonomous Region. So really there was no scope under the official program at all to meet with Tibetans as such. They provided us with a translator, but the translator couldn't even speak the local language. And so the only time that I got to meet with Tibetans was in fact in the evenings and at other times between the official program, where I would just walk around town. And even then, of course, you're concerned that you're being followed. There's language barriers. They make very, very significant barriers to journalists actually being able to speak to Tibetans and to find out what the other side, if you like, is feeling. Now, I managed to meet, finally, after 4 days, I only met a handful of Tibetans who spoke enough English who were willing to share their concerns with me. And those concerns were quite striking. However, that was very difficult to even find them.
Let's hear from listeners who are joining us. We have some who will be very well informed and others sort of looking in on Tibet maybe for the first time. We've got from Leon, Iowa, Abby calling. Hi, Abby. You're on the air.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question was, I wondered why China is so reluctant to grant autonomy to Tibet or even entertain negotiations. I thought maybe some of the other listeners may have a similar question.
It's a great question, Abby. Let me take it to Robbie Barnett in New York. Robbie, why such firm reluctance on China's part? I mean, there are only 6 million Tibetans. They're way up in the mountains. Why would a little more autonomy be so unappealing to Beijing?
Well, the 6 million Tibetans, or 5.5 million Tibetans, occupy or cover about one-third of China's land mass, and they're on all its sensitive borders. And right next to them to the north are another 8 or 9 million Uyghurs and other nationalities that also had independence for a period of time in the 1930s and 1940s. And of course, there's the question about Inner Mongolia. So the Chinese are very worried about a domino effect. If they give concessions to one area, that it might ripple across the country. And 60% of China is traditionally those areas that are not occupied by Chinese people. But we have to be fair to China. One of the problems for them is they think they have given autonomy. They call those areas autonomous regions. Mm-hmm. And Mao Zedong was very clear in 1950 that he was giving these people autonomy, probably because he was completely aware that historically Tibet, at least, was not an integral part of China, never been a province, and was ruled without much interference from China. So the Chinese have given autonomy. It just doesn't happen in practice. In fact, these places have less self-rule than a normal Chinese province. But it makes it very difficult to talk about it. China's convinced that it gives these people these local rights. It has a local Tibetan as the formal governor of the Tibetan Autonomous Region. But, of course, he's completely under the control of the local party secretary, who's always a non-Tibetan. So, But there's a larger issue here, which is China feels it's being humiliated by the West raising this issue, by the Dalai Lama going to the West. They feel it's a long-term plot started, they say, by the British 100 years ago to try to separate China. So there's a huge amount of nationalist emotion here.
Let's get a call from Ying in Cheshire, Connecticut. Ying, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to make a comment. I think, all Chinese people know Dalai Lama is financed by our government.
You mean the U.S. government?
Yeah.
That's
whatever some in our government budget. There's a small portion, but it's I think enough for kind of.
So you're saying that the U.S. government is behind support for the Dalai Lama? Why?
That's not a question for me. What I try to say is because this reason. They all see this their movement as a part of U.S. try to separate China, separate Tibet from China. So it's just in a way like make them more aware and more protective
of that territory. Ying, let us pick that up. Robbie Barnett, I was in China in the spring when there were protests against the Olympic torches that traveled around the world, many of them based on support for Tibet. And state television in China was showing over and over pictures of what was being described as American airplanes giving support to the Tibetans way back in the 1950s. Is there U.S. government support today for Tibetan exiles, or is it just all kinds of people around the world who may support the Dalai Lama?
Well, there's certainly American support for the exiles of a humanitarian kind.
Is it government support?
It was congressional support. That was the Congress said that 1,000 Tibetans could move to the U.S. in 1990, and it's considering allowing another 5,000 or so to come and settle here. And it helps with Fulbright scholarships, and we have a couple of people at Columbia, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of support, this kind of humanitarian work goes on all the time and probably in all countries in the world. Now, your speaker's completely right if she's speaking historically, as you mentioned. From about 1956... to something like 1968-69, the Americans, through the CIA, which had just been formed then, funded a military movement, a guerrilla war from northern Nepal of about 3,000 Tibetan guerrilla fighters who were basically sniping at Chinese convoys that were going through western Tibet at that time. The Americans pulled out of that altogether as they began to move closer to China, and Nixon went to China in 1971. So there is a record of the Americans doing that, and for that time, they seem to have supported Tibetan independence, but they haven't since. Their government's been very strong about saying that its support of Tibet is only about religion, non-violence, conflict resolution, and it very strongly says that Tibet is part of China. In fact, America's been rather quiet on the Tibet issue for the last year. Bush has got rather closer to China during his final year in office.
And Cameron Stewart, I've just got you for another 10 seconds. You had that rare chance to be in Tibet, but China doesn't appear to be eager to open it up much more widely anytime soon, does it?
No, it doesn't. In fact, it's quite interesting. The contrast between the rhetoric that we got from Chinese officials, they were very hardline against the Dalai Lama. They were very, very hardline as far as autonomy goes with Tibet. They said, as Robert alluded to, they said that there is autonomy, there's full religious freedom. The Tibetans have everything that they want. That was their consistent message in every single meeting that we went to. In fact, and when we questioned them, they were rather hostile to our questioning. And then you go out onto the streets and you see the presence of the soldiers, and you realize that they certainly do not believe they have the hearts and minds of the local Tibetans.
Cameron Stewart with The Australian in Melbourne, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the fate of Tibet, struggling with the power of China, the passage of time, and the aging of the Dalai Lama. Robert Barnett joins us from New York. He teaches modern Tibetan studies at Columbia University. And from Vancouver, Canada, we've been joined by Tsering Chakra. He's Tibetan scholar and professor at the University of British Columbia's Institute for Asian Research, born in Lhasa, capital of Tibet. Let me take a call from Chen Chi, calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Chen Chi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I came to the United States from Taiwan 20 years ago. And
from Taiwan,
Yes, and the Berlin Wall came down and when there's Tiananmen incident. And I can totally understand. I'm very sympathized with all the Tibetan leaders, and but I can also understand why the Chinese government doesn't want Tibet to declare independence, because, like the previous speaker said, that it will have a ripple effect, including Taiwan and Mongolians. On the other hand, I mean, I don't have the degree in political science, but I think that maybe the Tibetan leaders can use the faith, as a risk. I mean, faith is a risk factor, just like the previous leader said, because Chinese government is so humiliating by all these foreign governments. So maybe the Tibetans, the exo-Tibetans, can use faith as a protective factor, you know, turn around to appear to the general public in China, because right now I see that maybe the Chinese government is using the nationalism as a way to appear to, you know, to get most people's consensus and to want to crack down on the Tibetans. But why don't the Tibetans turn around and launch a public awareness campaign to appeal to the general public in China and to say that, you know, it's to everybody's benefits to maintain the status quo and to, you know, hopefully with the internet and, you know, the information.
Maybe there would be a way to do it, and that seems to be what the Dalai Lama is talking about in his latest comments just yesterday out of Dharamsala. Chen Chi, thanks for calling. Tsering Chakra, let's look first at the Dalai Lama's long effort to pressure China internationally. He's done a lot of that. He's found a lot of sympathy abroad, but so far, at least, China has not. It hasn't led China to loosen its policy on Tibet. Can it be fairly said that the Dalai Lama's approach has failed? And can you see a real prospect of changing public opinion inside China? I have to say, having been there in April, I found the nationalism Chen Chi's describing here, many Chinese people very upset about the international view and seemed to be clinging all the harder to Tibet, almost in defiance of world opinion.
Certainly, you're right, and that there is some really resurgence of Chinese nationalism and popular sentiments which support the Chinese government claims. As we heard from earlier caller who mentioned that the CIA or the American government are funding the Tibetan operation. And this is very much a strong propaganda that is carried out by the Chinese government to say that the Tibet movement is essentially Western conspiracy to undermine China's stability and its international stature. Certainly, there is no evidence whatsoever to say that the West is behind the Tibetan unrest. This is used as propaganda. And this has captured sort of thoughts of the Chinese populace. If you look at the internet or the popular Chinese language press in the West or in China, they're all wholeheartedly behind the Chinese government claim. They don't really deviate from the Chinese government propaganda to the absurd level, to more complex arguments. There is conformity between the populist Chinese public sentiment and the government view. Nevertheless, there are divergent views within China. When you look at the unrest that happened in March and April, the group of Chinese intellectuals from Beijing, about 103 intellectuals signed a petition. And that is very significant when you think that signing a petition has a serious repercussion on these individuals' lives and their opportunities and their status in China. And there are Chinese other intellectuals have written their accounts or views. But the problem is the way the government has engineered that popular sentiment development, the divergent, the more liberal, tolerant view of the Chinese intellectuals and people are submerged or drowned by this popular sentiment. But I feel now there is a change because of this fervor has slightly disappeared. There is much more reflection within the Chinese community to think about what's happening and to some kind of more liberal view is emerging within the Chinese community.
Robbie Barnett, how about it? You know, after earlier this month in Beijing, the high official there was very adamant here, saying China would never accept the Dalai Lama's demand for autonomy, said the Dalai Lama intends to split up China, reinstate a theocracy, carry out ethnic cleansing of Han Chinese. That hardly sounds conciliatory. What do you make of the Dalai Lama's long, many years long effort here and where it stands today? And what about this glimmer of hope that Tsering Shakya finds in Beijing among Chinese?
Well, a very significant moment last Friday where the Chinese government sentenced in Chengdu in western China, quite near Tibet, for the first time, a Chinese intellectual got a three-year prison sentence for writing on his blog articles or notes that seemed to be supportive of the Tibetans. So a Chinese person going to prison for doing that, that's a very significant change and indicates insecurity, nervousness by the government. And if we look at what you just mentioned, these officials in Beijing accusing the Dalai Lama of things like planning ethnic cleansing, that's not a sign of strength from China. If you talk to Chinese diplomats, they are deeply concerned about that kind of language coming out of their capital. It suggests that the officials who run Tibet policy for the Chinese government, or more precisely for the Communist Party, are in a sense out of control. Because that language, that kind of aggression about the Dalai Lama and about Tibetans, and this constant harping on about the violence that occurred in Lhasa in March the 14th, in only one of 100 or so protests, that divides Chinese people from Tibetans. It flames up hatred and antagonism. And that's very, very dangerous and unwise for China. So the question is, why are the Tibetan officials, the officials, Chinese officials in charge of Tibet, taking such a hard line? It raises doubts about whether the leadership in China is really fully in control of this issue or whether it's become a kind of nationalist drive from inside the bureaucracy.
The Chinese Tibet Daily, an editorial there saying recently, this is translated by the Associated Press, saying this would be an official view out of from the Chinese Tibetan government there. The Dalai Lama's so-called middle way is a naked expression of Tibet independence aimed nakedly at nakedly spreading the despicable plot of opposing the tide of history. Let's go to Cedar Falls, Iowa, and Vajpayee, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. This is a great show. I've been to China about six times, including the time when Tiananmen Massacre took place. Whenever I ask or raise the question of Tibet with Chinese students and teachers, they just went blank as if they didn't want to accept or they didn't know anything about it. All of us know that China is one of the most brutal regimes which kills, tortures, imprisons, and violates human rights of its own people, Han. Tibet is being politically and culturally being looted and raped, and we stand in silence. And most of our Western powers who champion human rights everywhere have been hypocritical. Tibet must, I hope, become a case for most brutal human rights violation. I hope Obama, Clinton will raise this issue to a new level and see that Tibet's anguish becomes global and human anguish. Otherwise, Tibetans will start saying it, that it's my let us, pass us, but do not forget us. We are the people of Tibet who have not spoken as yet. And this meeting in Dharamsala might be just the beginning of it.
Vajpayee, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Robbie Barnett, I mean, is there really leverage here? We saw the United Kingdom, London, going the other way just last week, backing away from its support for more autonomy. I mean, given the global clout of China, and right now in this economic meltdown, the financial clout of China, just for starters, are Western countries, foreign countries, really going to put this at the top of their agenda in dealing with China?
Well, it does look like the British wobbled severely, and it seems that they thought by giving away, tearing up the documents that said that Britain had always recognised Tibet as autonomous, it seems that the British just lost their head. They actually said that they thought this would lead China to be more concessional and more relaxed towards the Tibetan negotiators, and exactly the opposite happened a week later, as you've described. So what we seem to be seeing is that the financial meltdown produces spinning heads in the corridors of power in the West. That's very worrying for the West, that we're not really getting capable advice for our foreign policy that just says, hold firm, you know, don't wobble, don't get excited, and don't give important things away that are part of history. But in the long term, I think we're looking at a different kind of question. We're looking at a conversation between two groups where neither side can really hear the other side. Mm. And that means that there is possibility, at least in theory, and I think it's going to happen increasingly, where people can gradually find ways to listen. The problem in China seems to be a problem of Chinese people who think they gave hugely to Tibet. They gave them first socialism. They said they were giving them liberation from imperialism. They freed them from serfdom, and now they say they're giving them modernity. And always, from a Chinese point of view, all they get back is complaints mm-hmm. and lack of generosity. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's a lack of listening to what Tibetans are saying. But it ought to be possible for someone to get in there and say, you know, the Tibetan point of view is really quite reasonable, and the Chinese point of view, rather maybe uninformed in many ways, is also reasonable. There's a possibility there for some speaking and listening to be done.
Let's go to Ben, calling from Boston. Hi, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm just wondering if the... I've always wondered about this issue and wondering if the mass exodus option has ever been explored. I'm a Buddhist, and but I have a very dear friend in China, and I always avoid this issue. But the Tibetans' pride and their proud nationalism has always struck me as not very Buddha-like. And... you know, is there not room somewhere else for 6 million people to study and live Buddhism the way the Quakers and the Amish do?
You mean literally, Ben, a mass exodus as in Tibetans streaming out of the Himalayas and into, I don't know where, some other country? They would simply evacuate the homeland?
Absolutely. As a form of civil disobedience, just make their statement with their feet and move to Fiji. Why they would want to live in the worst climate in the world and fight to live in the Himalayas instead of Australia is absurd. And if they're Buddhist monks, all they should be caring about is studying and living Buddhism and, you know, fighting the Chinese army and trying to shame China is just, it's just making things worse.
You're broad-minded, sir, but let me put it to Tsering Shakya. What about it? Can you imagine anything along those lines ever being discussed, proposed? Mr. Shakya?
Well, you know, there has been a mass exodus since 1950 and 59. There have been steady number of Tibetans coming into exile into India. And prior to the protests, every year 3,000 or may escapes to India. There. So there has been a steady number of people escaping. And there has been in India flourishing of Tibetan Buddhist monasteries and Buddhist learning institutions. But of course, it's not quite simple as that. It's just uprooting yourself and reestablishing in another country. Firstly, you need a host nation who will be willing to take 6 million new migrants.
Unlikely.
Of course, unlikely to do that to happen. Of course, some. But the main problem is there is, of course, everybody's land is. People are very attached to their land. You know, it's not just a question of that. The Tibetans have been settled in the Tibetan plateau for thousands of years, and there is a historical memory about the place, their attachment, and the land is also sacred. There's a religious association between the land and the people. So it's not something you can just give up the land and just move.
Ravi, first, one caller is noting here that lithium is found in Tibet, valuable in the next wave of alternative energy and batteries. And with that, this caller says Tibet's fate is sealed to China. But I have to ask you about the Dalai Lama himself, 73 years old, has had some health issues recently. What happens if and when he moves out of his active role? Is succession clear? Does his middle way end with him?
Well, you're right. You're putting your finger on the issue that troubles probably most Tibetans. It does seem that inside Tibet and certainly outside Tibet, the support that the Dalai Lama has as a leader, and I should say as a political national leader, not just as a religious leader, is really huge, unimaginably strong. And he has been, you know, the most successful Tibetan leader really in history in terms of reconsolidating the exile community and making it a subject of world interest, even though he's failed in the political objective of getting a resolution of the conflict with China. So his succession is a hugely important issue. The Tibetans have a very good system of finding leaders in the sense that it creates a charismatic leader who can have a lot of support and a lot of potential. Mm. But it's a disaster for successions because when one dies, you have to spend 3 or 4 years searching for the next one, the child who is said to be the incarnation, and then that child's got to grow up for another 16 years. So the Dalai Lama has said that he wants people to devise a new system. He talked about this yesterday. And it looks like Tibetan exiles, probably trying to talk also with Tibetans inside, will try to think of a new way. They're discussing possible appointments. They're discussing the Dalai Lama recognizing himself reincarnated before he goes. They're discussing other lamas stepping into his shoes. So there's a lot of potential flexibility here for the Tibetans, but whatever choice they make, the Chinese will appoint their own Dalai Lama once this Dalai Lama dies. So we're heading for conflict there.
It sounds as though we may be speaking again. I hope we can. Ravi Barnett at Columbia in New York, thank you very much for your observations and for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And Tsering Shakya at the University of British Columbia. Tsering Shakya, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.